Good morning. Delighted to welcome you all in this bright new year. We have a special welcome for the students from Hamilton High School. Would they please stand? We're delighted you were able to join us this morning. You may be seated. Thank you. Students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. We've been running this program with the State Bar of Wisconsin for many years. It is a national award-winning program. We invite students from across the state to join us for an oral argument. If these students agree to come, they're given materials about the case. They may engage in activities relating to the case or the court system. Come to oral argument and after this second case, ordinarily meet with a justice of the court assigned that day for a discussion of the procedural aspects of what cases do we take, how do we hear them, how do we decide them, etc. The discussion is not on the substantive matters of the case. This group from Hamilton cannot stay for that discussion, which would have been with Justice Bradley. I didn't ask you, Justice Bradley, but is there anyone in this room who wants to stay for such a discussion and meet with Justice Bradley?
You could have asked it a little differently. Would love to, but is unable.
Would love to and is able. Okay. Because she would love to, and she is able. All right. Justice Bradley, you are relieved of duties for today. Well, we've met with the students. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting, I will look, because last time I did it by rote, and someone wasn't sitting in his or her seat, so now I will look. I'll start from the left, Justice Michael Gableman, who is seated. Next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack, who is seated. My immediate left is Justice Crooks, Patrick Crooks, who is seated. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, and I'm here. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. That constitutes all seven of us sitting on this case. So let me call the second case, 2012 AP 1812, County of Grant versus Daniel A. Vogt. Representing the County of Grant is Assistant District Attorney from Lancaster, Anthony Pozorski. Mr. Pozorski, you may proceed. You have 25 minutes, counsel, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal after we hear from Jeffrey Scott.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. When we look at cases like Mendenhall by the United States Supreme Court and all the way through Wisconsin versus Young by this court, we know that law enforcement officers can approach people on the street, let's say on a park bench. We know that they can ask for identification, such as a driver's license. And based upon those cases and the cases in between, we know that they can pose some questions to that individual. So long as that person is not made to feel as if he or she cannot leave. So this case takes all of that law, but now we don't have a person sitting on the park bench. We have a person sitting in the car. And the officer, you know, it's midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, stops behind the car and approaches the car on the driver's side. Eventually asks for identification, eventually asks questions. But the issue then in this case, which makes it different than Mendenhall and Young, is whether when the officer approaches the car, whether knocking on the window or rapping on the window and directing the occupant, in this case the driver, to roll down the window, whether that transforms the encounter, which according to Mendenhall and Young and all the cases in between would otherwise be consensual encounter, whether that transforms that encounter into a seizure. The trial court in this case, Judge Vandehey, decided that it was not a seizure.
What's the Mendenhall test?
The Mendenhall test is the reasonable standard test, whether a reasonable person would, under those circumstances, feel free to leave. Counsel Attorney Scott made an argument, both at the trial court and in the brief, you know, on the appellate level, that, the defendant, Mr. Vogt, was not free to leave for various reasons, but the first reason is because he was trapped there, because the officer was parked behind him, so he couldn't back up. The officer was standing on the left side of the squad car, so he couldn't go to the left. There was a soda machine by the park. This is a public parking lot, boat landing. There was a park to the right.
Does the public parking lot have hours for parking?
No. The park was closed, but the public parking lot had no hours. And so he couldn't go to the right because of a soda machine, and the defense position was that he could not go forward because the Mississippi River was there. I bring that up, and we dispute that, because the evidence would be that going forward, he would have been anywhere, based upon the defendant, Mr. Vogt's testimony, anywhere from 20 feet to the river to maybe as far as 50 feet from the river.
So he had time to move up and turn around and go out. That's
right.
Your
we
position?
Felt, yeah, we felt that he would not have been trapped. But I bring that up even if, because you asked about what the standard was, Chief Justice, and if he had in fact been trapped in the sense that he was closer to the river, well, that doesn't mean that he's automatically trapped. Then the question changes, or the standard changes a little bit, not in terms of principle, but in this court decided in Williams and said if that's the case where the person is not free to go for reasons other than the officer, and in this case the soda machine to the right and the river to the front, then the question isn't whether he felt free to leave. Then the standard would be whether a reasonable person would feel that he or she could disregard the officer's questions. So either way, it's kind of the same standard, but if in fact that does become an issue for the court as to whether he was trapped, then it's whether he could just wave the officer off.
So your position is that under Mendenhall, he didn't have to roll down the window?
Correct.
He did not have to stay where he was?
Correct.
He was perfectly free to ignore the cop and pull his car forward and turn around and leave?
Right.
Therefore, he was, under Mendenhall, free to leave. A reasonable person would think he was free to leave and disregard the police. Just like the person on the street, if the police officer says, can you stop a minute and answer a question, is free to say, just walk right by and ignore that.
Right. Right. The person on the street would be free to say no thank you, or not even say no thank you, and just turn around and keep going. And our position is that a reasonable person in the defendant's position would have felt the same.
You know what bothers me about this argument? And that is another statute that is referred to by the defendant and by the circuit court judge. And it's 346.04, right? You know the statute I'm talking about. 346.04. So was he free to leave? 346.04 says in subsection 1, no person shall refuse to comply with a lawful order, signal, or direction of a traffic officer. If you say he can refuse the direction. The direction was to lower your window, right?
Right.
Subsection says one, no. Two, subsection two, no operator of a vehicle, and he was operating a vehicle, he pulled in, right, shall disobey the instructions of an official traffic sign or signal. Okay. This is not a sign or signal, unless otherwise directed by a traffic officer. 2T, no operator of a vehicle after receiving a visible or audible signal to stop the vehicle from a traffic officer. This guy a traffic officer, this deputy
yes.
sheriff?
Okay. Yes, he is.
Or marked police vehicle. We had a marked police vehicle.
Yes, he did.
Shall knowingly resist the traffic officer by failing to stop. Well, he was already stopped. But if he moved, would that violate 2T? Number 3, no operator of a vehicle after having received a visual or audible signal from the traffic officer shall knowingly flee or shall knowingly attempt to elude any traffic officer by willful or wanton disregard of such signal so as to interfere with or endanger the operation of a vehicle or the traffic officer or other vehicles or pedestrian, nor shall the operator increase the speed, this was a stopped car,
right.
of the vehicle, right?
Right.
Would he be violating sub 3 if he moved his car?
Arguably, but...
Arguably,
but,
yes. And
yes.
What is the offense? Is that a felony, a misdemeanor?
Well, under sub 3, it's a felony. Under sub 2T, it's a misdemeanor.
All right. So you say arguably. That means I don't know, as the driver of the vehicle, why, whether I would be engaging in a felony if I moved my car. Is that right?
That would be true.
So I am not free to leave because I am facing a criminal violation.
Well, when I say arguably, I mean arguably by the defense, but any statute has to be read in light of how the court interprets the Constitution, how this court interprets this Constitution, mm-hmm. how the Supreme Court interprets the United States Constitution. And in the United States case, in, I think, Illinois versus Wardlow, they talked about approaching somebody without reasonable suspicion, and then the
by
person
the way,
taking
was there,
off.
By the way, was there reasonable suspicion here?
No.
Okay. No. Was he exercising a caretaker function?
No.
Okay.
We're
all clear from that. Right.
The officer did say when he pulled in behind the vehicle and called dispatch, he said, "I have a suspicious vehicle here," and then got out to check it. But I would argue that was a poor choice of words. He just wanted to check to see on how the people were doing or what they were doing. There was no reasonable suspicion of any illegal activity.
Counsel, you're using a legal term here, reasonable suspicion.
Right.
But take us through what the officer was thinking when he observed the car. I mean, the place is closed, but perhaps not the parking area.
Right.
It's 1 o'clock in the morning. Is that right?
Right.
So the area has been closed for 2 hours. It's Christmas night, is it?
Right.
Christmas night.
Right.
At 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Right next to the... Is this Lover's Lane?
Is it Christmas morning? Christmas morning?
It was December 25th, so I would say Christmas morning.
1 a.m.
Yes.
Christmas morning, not Christmas night.
Oh, Christmas night. Or
Christmas
morning.
Christmas morning.
I'm sorry.
Maybe
okay.
They were going to Mass or coming from Mass.
Maybe. That, you know, one could argue that, certainly.
What is going through the officer's mind? And whatever that was it reasonable to take the action that he did?
Well, you know, that's ultimately the ultimate crux, because that's what the Fourth Amendment focuses on, is unreasonable versus reasonable. So this officer, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, he's riding by, and he sees a car there in the boat landing. And like I say, I do not view it as a reasonable suspicion the way we understand reasonable suspicion under the law, but he thought it was suspicious, and I think, as I think about this, I think that maybe that was a poor choice of words on his part. Maybe he meant it was just odd. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, it's winter time, it's Christmas time, and the boat landing is open to the public, but nobody's going in and out of the river. at the Mississippi River at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the winter, and the vehicle is there with the engine running. So he decides to stop and walk up and say, how are you doing, and anything going on here that I should be concerned about? No. And so that's what he's thinking about.
This was not a good Terry stop.
No, that's correct.
Okay. Terry stop means that there's reasonable suspicion to believe that there is a crime or an offense, right?
Right.
That's why if you see the headlight out, you can stop the car, right?
Right.
Because there's reasonable grounds to believe that this person is violating a law of this state.
Right.
It was, according to your brief, Deputy, I'm reading from page 7, Deputy Small made it crystal clear that he did not conduct a traffic stop, meaning a Terry stop,
right,
upon his approach to the defendant, right, because the defendant had no, apparently from the record, no defective car. He was not in a place that he had, should not be, right?
Right.
He had every right to be in that parking lot, right?
Exactly.
There was nothing in the record showing that the park had been trespassed or that there had been destruction of the park property at any time. It's not in the record, right?
Right.
So you don't think he's there doing bad, right?
Right.
All right. And then it says, Deputy Small made it crystal clear that if the defendant had driven off, he would have let him go.
Correct.
So the whole thing was set up that Deputy Small didn't think he could stop him, and therefore the defendant had no reason to think he was anything but free to go. Isn't that your total argument?
Right.
Well, here's the problem. And this is your other part of your argument. If he were on the street, standing outside his car, on that parking lot, the officer could have gone up to him and said, can I help you? Or might have said, it's late at night, what are you doing here? Right?
Right.
And that would have not been viewed as a seizure. Right?
Right.
And so your position is, just because he's in a car and the officer says, roll down your window, that's not a seizure.
Correct.
That's really your total argument.
Yes. I think I'd have a few more things to say, but that's that's pretty much it.
Lunch? Yeah. Say them. Go ahead and say them.
Well, because, as I was mentioning before, that every statute has to be read in light of the Constitution.
Okay, which statute are we reading now?
You're 346.04.
Good.
And that Wardlow case from the United States Supreme Court says that if a person is, if you do not have a reasonable suspicion, and if that person chooses to leave, then that person has to be able to be free to leave. And it would depend, according to my reading of materials regarding Wardlow, that, you know, if the person squeals out, is fishtailing to get out of there or something, that might raise a suspicion. But otherwise, if the person just drives off, in order to keep in standing with our analysis of the Fourth Amendment, the person has to be able to be free to leave.
Do you really think, counsel, that that's how it plays out in the real world? In a previous chapter in my life, I served as an assistant district attorney and a district attorney. And I can see the police report that probably would have resulted that might have gone along the lines of, upon the defendant observing my approach to his vehicle, he engaged the vehicle in drive and drove off. Reasonable articulable suspicion for a stop?
Based upon the circumstances you described, no.
Based upon the circumstances of this case,
right,
plus what I described.
Right. I would say no.
A police officer would not have stopped someone who, upon visual contact, observed the officer approaching the vehicle at 1 o'clock in the morning, parked next to the river, at a park that had been closed, albeit the parking lot not.
An officer may have stopped the person, but the evidence should have been then suppressed.
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear the answer.
I say the question was, well, wouldn't an officer have stopped somebody under those circumstances? And I say, yeah, an officer might very well have stopped him if he had just driven off in a normal manner, but the evidence should have been then suppressed under that Wardlow case.
So it wouldn't have been a lawful stop.
Right. Right.
But what about 346.04? It just says an operator receiving a visual or audible signal shall, and then it says knowingly, which our case law, I think it was Hansen, read intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't, if our guy, Vogt, had moved the car, he did that intentionally.
Right.
Intentionally attempt to elude the officer, which he would have been doing, and you say he had a right to do. Right?
Right.
And then it says by willful or wanton disregard. Well, the court didn't in Hansen put much weight, if any, a willful and wanton, viewed that as intentional. Right?
Right.
Okay. So we have an intentional attempt to elude the traffic officer by this guy after he has a hand signal. And he increases the speed of his vehicle. That falls under three exactly. And if the court writes an opinion the way you want, it means that anyone who gets a sign from a traffic officer can just move that car, increase the speed of the car, and leave the scene. Now, is that the law of the state? The law of the state is you got under three is you can't do that.
I do have a couple of responses to that. The easiest one for me to the argument to make is this would be that statute would be more applicable if Mr. Vogt was parked on the street. 346.04 only applies to highways. And does not apply to areas open to the public. So
highways are open to the public. That's
right.
Number one. Number two, this is a parking lot.
Right.
And if the guy had been picked up for drunk driving in a parking lot, that would have been as good as on the highway. He would have been operating.
But only
and
because the statute says that the drunk driving law applies to the highway, applies to the parking lot.
It doesn't say anything about a highway. Sub 3 says nothing about a highway.
No, it'll say that in the beginning of Section 346, that these rules apply only to highways unless otherwise specified. And the only one that specifies otherwise is the drunk driving law.
Well, it says here, this chapter applies exclusively upon highways except as otherwise expressly provided. So you're telling me if you elude the traffic officer in the parking lot, it's not, well, he's going to get on that highway in about 30 seconds. So as soon as he hits the highway, he's now in violation of 346.043.
Once he's on the highway.
Well, he's going to be on the highway, isn't he? I mean, how's he going to get out? He's not going to keep driving in circles on the parking lot. He's going to be on a highway.
Well, if he chooses to flee, but...
Ah, you don't. If you choose to flee, you're violating, you're a felony. That's my point. I mean, that's what's bothering me about the case. Cop can go and knock on the door, can ask questions, but the driver has to be feel free to leave. I agree that's the Mendenhall. I agree that makes it consistent with the person on the street that the police officer asks questions. But the difference between the person on the street and the driver is 346.043. Subsection 3, which in this state penalizes failing to, no, intentionally failing to comply with a officer's signal and attempting to elude the traffic officer by increasing the speed. Now, maybe that's too hard a reading, but Hansen was a very tough case, and that said there's no good faith exception either under 346.04. If you violated, even if in Hansen the guy thought that the police officer was beating him up and had already ripped his shirt and tried to put his hands on the defendant. And the court said, no good faith defense. If you violate this, the fact that you have a good faith, it doesn't matter. That's what bothers me about the case. Because I think you're right up to that point. So dissuade me.
Well, the Wardlow case does interpret the Constitution and says that a person has to be able to free to leave if there's no reasonable suspicion. So let's say a prosecutor like me filed the charge for fleeing or filed the charge for misdemeanor fleeing, whichever the case may be. In light of that Wardlow case, that conviction should not go through.
Well, in Hansen, it went through, didn't it?
Yes.
With no good faith exception, no exceptions. You violate the statute, that's it. That's what Hansen said. I dissented in Hansen, but I lost. As soon as I say a dissent, that means I lost.
Right. Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm a good loser. But what comes up is these cases arise in a different fact situation, and then you're stuck with your precedent.
Well, I would agree.
Okay.
But all I can make, you know, two arguments is the Wardlow case regarding how the Constitution is interpreted, and then what the court said in the St. Martin case, which is we decide the case based upon the facts before us. We don't decide the case today based upon how the law might apply to a different set of facts in the future.
Sure. Because the law depends on the facts in this circumstance.
Right. So in this case, we don't have a person who fled. In this case, we don't have a person who tried to get away. The issue is whether a reasonable person would have felt free to disregard the officer.
And the theory is that we all know all the law, right? That's the theory.
Yeah,
we know that's not true.
Right.
But that's what we operate on. So you operate on the theory that he understands the law, that if it's, I think people understand the law that if you don't obey an officer, you can be in deep trouble. Obstruction of justice, fleeing, escape, you know, there are lots of these. Which ones you fit under, I might not know, but I sure know you don't do what the officer tells you to do. The law protects the officer and wants to protect the officer because it wants to make us all obey and have a lawful and orderly society, right?
Right.
And so saying he could have fled was not very realistic to answer Justice Michael Gableman's realism issue, right? Most of us would not disobey the order, right? Would you? You don't have to answer that.
Well, I always hesitate when that question's asked because I work with law enforcement officers all the time. So when they approach me, it's as if I'm approaching any, you know, I mean, it's so common that the idea of fleeing doesn't cross my mind. So it's unfair to use me as an example because I'm talking and working with them on a daily basis.
You know, counsel, trying to play this out, and I understand your red light is on, so I'm going to make this as brief as I can.
I'm sorry.
No. But to move the saw a little closer to the bone, does it come down here to whether the officer made a request, you know, please roll down your window. May I speak with you? Versus roll down your window. Is that really what the case law compels us to do here, or what would you suggest be the dividing line?
I don't think the case law does compel you to then therefore rule in favor of the defense. I know the Court of Appeals suggested that. What if the officer had used pleas?
Yeah.
And so I'll try to answer that. I don't think that we should require the officers to use pleas under this set of circumstances. First of all, the windows are closed.
Then I'm interested in your opinion, but the red light is on. Then how do we differentiate between the officer's directive that compels the individual in the automobile with the rolled up window versus the hypothetical person you started out talking about sitting on the park bench, the distinction being that there is a physical divider, a physical barrier, preventing normal conversation absent either a request or a directive from law enforcement to put the window down.
Well, I can't say where the line should be drawn for all cases. I just don't think the law should be drawn that knocking rapping on the window and directing him either verbally or by motion to roll down the window should transform that encounter into a seizure. And I say that, if I could just be heard briefly.
Yes, sir.
When we look at those cases like Mendenhall and Young, they look at cases, there's two sides to the equation. There's the officer's conduct, and did the officer's conduct cause the person to feel free not to leave? I would agree that most people would stay there. I would agree that most people would stay, but the law tells us the fact that most people would stay does not make it non-consensual.
The law says that people can leave unless they're directed by the officer to stay. And I guess what I'm thinking out loud is that a directive, I don't know what else to call it, to roll the window down?
Right.
I mean, you can't roll the window down and not stay. I mean, I don't think people would interpret it as roll the window down so you can wave goodbye to me.
Right. Outside. No, I would agree with you.
So that's what I'm trying to get at, and that's what I meant by my metaphor about the saw closer to the bone. Where do we understand the importance of this case, obviously, but in order to keep a cogent, coherent case line of case law,
we've
got to figure out how our application of the law to this case is going to affect future cases.
When I look at those cases like the Mendenhall and the Young, they talk about whether the officer's conduct was so intimidating, that's Mendenhall, whether it was so intimidating to cause the person not to feel free to leave. And what does intimidating mean? I look it up in the dictionary. It means instilling fear. When I look at Young, and then it's, or Delgado, INS versus Delgado, and it says you look to see whether the officer's conduct was so oppressive as to cause a person to feel free not to leave. And when I look at it, I don't see knocking on the window or directing the person with my finger to roll down the window as qualifying as being so intimidating as to cause the person to be afraid or to be so oppressive as to cause the person to feel like I'm afraid to do anything but what the officer tells me. I think that these cases are hard because the people stay. And so then it's easy to look at that, and these cases are never decided 7-0 or 9-0 because they're tough cases. And when people stay, I think the reasonable person is more likely to stay out of respect, not out of fear. It's a law enforcement officer. He wants to talk to me. I respect the officer. I'll talk to him. But that doesn't mean that the officer's conduct is so intimidating as to transform that respect into fear, or that the officer's conduct is so oppressive as to transform that person who decides to stay to change that respect into fear. And that's the crux of the case. I mean, you've nailed the case on the head, and because you asked most of the questions along with Chief Justice, and so that's the issue here, but it comes down to most people staying, not because they're afraid to leave, but because they have nothing to be, the reasonable person stays because he doesn't have anything to be afraid of. And that's the difference. And I apologize for going over, but I appreciate the question.
No, that was in direct response to my question.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Scott, you defend our defense counsel. You have 30 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Pizarski, Mr. Avote. My name is Jeffrey Scott. I am in the firm of Block Scott and Heenan in Platteville, and I represent Daniel Vogt. I think the question is what is, in fact, is a seizure within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment? And as we've been going over this, it can be a very, very fine line. And that's what Mr. Vogt's case brings us here today. And you have to decide today whether an officer, without reasonable suspicion or probable cause, approaches a vehicle at night that was illegally parked in a parking lot and raps loudly on the window and commands a person to roll down that window, is seized within the Fourth Amendment.
Counsel, with due respect, I don't think those are the facts. The facts are found by the trial court, and the trial court said there was, and I quote, no evidence that Deputy Small, quote, commanded Mr. Vogt to roll down his window by tapping on the window and motioning for him to roll down the window. I think we do need to focus on the deputy's conduct, but there are certain things that are findings of fact. Now, am I wrong in believing whether he commanded him to roll down the window is a finding of fact?
In the findings of fact, I believe Judge VanDeHay indicated that he listened to the evidence and he thought that it was somewhere between. If the court would look at the testimony at the motion hearing and at the of Officer Small and at the trial in this matter, Officer Small indicates that he doesn't really remember how he approached. He testified that he assumed that he knocked on the window, right, that he assumed that he doesn't even remember at the motion hearing whether he asked them to roll it down the window or not. It's only at the trial that the officer finally says, now his memory seems to be getting better, and he says, now I've motioned the defendant to roll down his window.
Right, and I understand that there are differences, and I respect the problems that often causes for counsel when they come before us. But as an appellate judge, I have certain standards that I will apply to a trial court's findings of fact, and I will not set them aside unless they are clearly erroneous. And what I read to you was a decision by the court after the full hearing on this matter, and the court says there is no evidence that Deputy Small, quote, commanded Mr. Vogt to roll down the window. So unless that's a conclusion of law rather than a finding of fact, I pretty much have to defer to that being the circumstances, don't I?
I would believe that would be his finding of law, because the conclusion would be contrary to the evidence that has been presented in the motion hearing in the trial.
Okay, so you want me to say that that's clearly erroneous?
Yes, I would ask you to find that.
Okay.
Well, based upon the testimony of Dan Vogt himself and of the witness, and the witness, Kimberly Russell, had nothing to gain or lose by testifying in this particular hearing. She said that she was a friend of Dan Vogt, hadn't seen him in 4 years. They had gone to high school together. And then she was the one that testified that the officer rapped loudly on the window, and that he commanded him to roll down the window and to produce his driver's license.
On page appendix 11 of the state's brief is the circuit court's decision. On page 8, appendix 8, while it is unclear exactly what happened next, it appears he knocked on the window and motioned for the driver to roll down the window. Did you ask him to roll down the window? Answer, this is to the officer. I don't recall. It might have been already down. I can't remember. This is December 25. Okay, did you, this is on December 12th, did you knock on the door, window, and knock on the door? How I would like to know a little bit more how you approached it. You just said, and this must be the police report, I made contact with the driver. Answer correct. I can only assume that it being in December, this is the officer, that it was probably cold out and the window was probably up and I may have knocked on the window to make contact with him. So what appears he knocked was the was what the court said. Then on page 11 is the language Justice Rogenstack referred to, and in quotes is the word commanded versus request. I mean, trial court says commanded. There's no evidence he commanded. It must remember the defendant to show the preponderance. So the question is whether that was a fact or law, because we know from the facts what the officer said. It then goes on in the next full paragraph, second full paragraph. Certainly, Small was engaged in an innocuous act, but allowing an officer to even suggest that a driver not operate his or her vehicle until that driver rolls down the window and engages in face-to-face contact when there is no reason for suspicion comes very close to a seizure. That sounds like law, too. Trying to determine if the officer commanded the driver roll down the window or merely suggested, this goes back to the questioning of Justice Gableman, is problematic, said the trial court. So it made no finding whether it was commanded or suggested because, said the trial court, no words were spoken. So he finally doesn't make a finding whether it's commanded or whether it's suggested, and ultimately finds out that, ultimately concludes on page 12 as a matter of law, it appears that courts who have found that when officers engage in activity that ordinary citizens could engage in are not showing authority, didn't pull a gun, etc., do not address the significant fact that disobeying the lawful officer's orders of an officer can lead to obstructing charges. Nonetheless, this is the question I've been raising. So Judge Van Zay raised that very question. He said, nonetheless, and then he looked at various courts of appeals decisions and some may say are conflicting. Appellate courts have overwhelmingly applied Mendenhall to find that the type of initial contact that occurred here is not a seizure. So whatever it was, command, request for Van de Hay, majority rule was it's not a seizure. That's a question of law. So I'm hard-pressed by this. I think the judge, frankly, did a wonderful job, and it's a very good explanation of the law in this area. But he did not make a finding that it was command or request, loud knock, soft knock, no knock, because he didn't have to. He said, regardless of that, the courts say it's not a seizure. And the courts disregard whether or not that can lead to obstructing charges if you disobey.
Well,
now what's the where do you find otherwise? And any time you start saying in your brief is replete with this, this was a loud knock, this was a command, he did it in a voice that was threatening, or anything like that, you're going to have trouble with the court because there's no such finding in the trial court's decision.
I believe that he indicated that there was some knocking, or at least on the window, wasn't
he? He being who?
The judge.
Yeah, but he being short, smart, too, said, I don't remember, but it's probably, window was probably shut.
Well, one thing you have here is a problem with the officer when he has his report and he says, I made contact. Then the next thing a problem we have is when an officer says that, I don't remember. I assume that it was December 25th. And that he had the window up.
Did you check the weather for December 25 at 1 a.m. in Grant County?
I didn't, but I can tell you in the video that shows that there's ice in the parking lot immediately in front of exhibit number one, shows that there's ice that has come up from the Mississippi River, and you can also see in exhibit number one the exhaust coming out of the vehicle, of Mr. Vogt's vehicle, indicating that it is cool, and the officer indicated that he had his long sleeve, but he did not have his overcoat on that day, but I believe he said it was cold out. I'm not certain on that.
Counsel, drawing on the questions of both Justice Rogensack and the Chief Justice, I wonder what facts as found in the record lead you to conclude that if this court has two columns in which it could assign the facts of this case, either a consensual contact with law enforcement or a seizure, what are the facts as they have been established on the record that lead you to conclude, and therefore you ask us to conclude, it was a seizure?
Okay. I believe Mr. Attorney Pozorski misspoke when this was a what the officer testified to was that he was driving down which I call Main Street, I think it's Prime Street in the city of village of Cassville, and that he was actually followed Mr. Vogt down that street and saw him turn into the parking lot that is open 24/7, and then pull up and park. And he just moved he pulled into the parking lot area close to where the boat ramp is. And that, so the officer testified to, he actually saw him drive, and the officer also testified that he saw no reasonable suspicion, no probable cause. And so, but he thought that it was suspicious that a vehicle at 1 o'clock in the morning would pull into a public parking lot. The reason why I thought I bring up the illuminated pop machine is not that he really blocks, there's a fence that blocks his exit to the right in the park. The illuminated parking pop machine shows that it's open to the public 24/7, and because it's illuminated, and it's asking people to come buy my pop. He pulled into there. The officer pulls up, and be right behind him, and slightly offset. And if you look at the video, he's very, very close. He doesn't turn on his emergency lights. The only thing he does, he leaves on his lights, pulls up behind Mr. Vogt's laser.
Perhaps I was not clear in my question, and I apologize if I wasn't. I'm not asking you to recite all of the salient facts. Mm-hmm. What I'm asking you to do is to point to those facts only, which you believe convert this or compel us to assign this the label of seizure.
Okay. Here we have, the officer pulls up behind Mr. Vogt's blazer there, and then he gets out of his vehicle. He is in full uniform. He does not have an overcoat on, and he approaches the vehicle, and he wraps, if the facts say wraps on the window, he wrapped on the window. However, he says that he directed him to, and even the district attorney's brief says in two spots that he directed, the officer directed Mr. Vogt to roll down his window. And so right there, rapping on a window, officer standing on your vehicle on the left. Does anyone think that they're free to ignore that rap on the window and to drive out of the parking area?
What if
I'm going to also go into when we talk about Mendenhall or Florida versus Royer, you also have to look at the surrounding circumstances to see if a person in Mr. Vogt's position, a reasonable person in Mr. Vogt's position, would have felt free to leave under this circumstance. But here we have a vehicle, he's parked in on the back, there's no doubt about that, because he's the officer's vehicles there. We can see that on the video, Exhibit 1. To the right, there is no doubt that there is a park that closes at 11 o'clock and a fence that runs along that park. So he cannot turn right. And left, if the officer's standing there, rapping on the window, then you can't turn left, otherwise, or you may injure the officer. And then we have going forward. But I would ask you, if you believe that he could have thought he would go forward and turn, then I would ask you to look at exhibit number 1, the first 35 seconds of the video, or look at 19 minutes and 10 seconds, and that is when it shows the video of the officer shows that he turns away from Mr. Vogt's vehicle, and then that shows that there's not very much room in front of the vehicle, and that there's ice that has came up from the Mississippi River that also would prevent him from going forward and turning left. So my position is that all avenues for him to ignore the officer were also blocked. And so if you apply Mendenhall and his test, that would Mr. Vogt under, or a reasonable person in Mr. Vogt's position, feel that he was free to ignore the officer and leave? Judge Van Hay indicates, I don't think he could have rolled down the window and left at the same time. And at that point in time, when that officer came up, Mr. Vogt had three options, really. Ignore the officer and try to get out some way, with maybe hurting him, and maybe subjecting himself to fleeing charges. He could have rolled down his window, or he could have maybe just ignored him and not done anything. Let's look at it this way. Let's say at 1 o'clock now, we have an ordinary citizen that would have parked behind Mr. Vogt's vehicle and came up and rapped on his window. Would he have rolled down his window? No, he probably would have locked the door, or else he might have tried to drive away under that circumstance. But when you see a badge and a gun and an officer rapping on the window, you're going to feel like you're obligated to stay. And even if he felt like he could leave, all avenues of to leave were blocked to him. So I believe under the Mendenhall or Florida versus Royer case of law that shows that there, under this circumstance, he was seized within the Fourth Amendment, and that there were no avenues for him to leave. And if he would have left, I believe he would have been picked up before he would have gotten out of the our subjective intent in that is just what happened that night. We never got that far. Officer says that he wouldn't have stopped him. I question that, but that's what the officer testified to.
Scott, I'm kind of interested. If you would put yourself in the position of the officers, in the officer's position, what do you think the officer should have done?
I think there's lots of things the officer could have done that wouldn't have been considered a seizure, in my opinion. If this officer would have came up and just simply stood by the vehicle, no seizure. We know by Young, I believe it is, that he could have shined his spotlight in. He could have shined his flashlight into the vehicle, no seizure. He could have walked around the vehicle, no seizure. He could have, I believe he could have waited there at the window and waited and shined it in, and then and Mr. Vogt rolled down the window. Or let's just change the facts a little bit more. Let's say the officer comes up and says nicely, "Would you please roll down the window?" I think that's a different issue once again. The issue is here there's lots of things. He could have just stood there or shined the lights in like Young did, they did in Young's case. But he chose to do something more. He chose to show police authority. And that's what Mendenhall talks about, is there a sufficient amount of authority there, make a person feel that they were not free to leave.
Let me ask, When the officer, if the officer shined a flashlight or spotlight of some sort in the car, wouldn't that be showing police authority?
Technically, that could be, but that's under Young, that has not been found to be the case. I agree with the state that the officer has the right to approach people, walk around cars, look into cars, and do things. It's once they have he knocks on a window or whatever the rap on the window, then he's requiring something, and he's got a badge on, he's got a gun on, people like Mr. Volz are not going to feel free that that he has the right to leave.
Well, he could have just parked the car adjacent to Mr. Volz, could have parked it outside the parking lot, and just waited for Mr. Volz to drive. And probably within a few moments, if he carefully observed the car, he would have found some defect on the car, because as the U.S. Supreme Court has noted, you can find a defect in almost any car, or that the guy maybe was too slow or too fast or turned into the wrong lane somewhere, which almost everybody does sooner or later, and then made a lawful traffic stop, made the guy roll down the window, smelled the alcohol, given him a sobriety test, and all would be well. He was following this car. That's your that's what you tell us was the testimony, right?
Yes. I believe.
How long did he follow this car?
I don't believe it's in the saw the record would indicate that he was driving on Prime Street in Cassville. My client was driving in Prime Street in Cassville, and he followed him, I believe, a couple of blocks, where my client then turned into the parking lot.
I might have turned in, too, so I could avoid being found on some sort of traffic violation.
That's what somewhat surprised me, because generally you can find that some reason to stop. As you've said, I've been doing this for 28 years, and I believe that the officers generally can either will wait and say, okay, that looks suspicious. So then they park a block away, and then they see if he makes a stop, sees if he uses his blinker, and things like that, so that they can decide to pull him over and investigate. But in all those cases, that would be failure. If it's a breaking of the law, then it's probable cause, justifying the stop. If it's a reasonable suspicion, then we need maybe the Waldner factors or something more. And if this case was a case where they thought that they had the community caretaker function, he would have been coming up and just saying, and maybe wouldn't even rapped on the window if he was coming, are you all right? That probably would be acceptable.
But there's no such claim here.
No. There are no claims. The state has not ever brought forth the argument of community caretaker function. It doesn't fit the situation because he didn't have his flashers light on. He had his lights on. He was in park, and the vehicle was running. So community caretaker function was not very good. And we have the officer freely admitted that he had no reasonable suspicion or probable cause for a stop. I would like to point out that the officer, though, slips in his testimony at the trial. I would note that he testifies that he did stop the vehicle, and then he backs up and says, no. The only thing that is missing in this case from a stop or from an investigative stop in this would be the fact that the officer, in fact, did not stop this vehicle and did not put on his emergency brakes. But I would ask the court to find that the functional equivalent of turning on those emergency lights would be the rapping on the window with a badge right at his head height and a gun at his side and directing him some way to roll down the window.
No, go ahead. Counsel, it is that last part, directing him to roll down the window. Earlier when Justice Gableman asked a question about rolling down the window and then made the comment about probably not rolling down the window to have him say goodbye as he takes off, I found a little humorous, and I guess I still do find a little humorous. But that is the essence in this totality of circumstances case that the circuit court focused on. The circuit court, in Appendix 11, says the defendant was arguably temporarily seized as he could not have both driven away and rolled down his window. And that's the point that Justice Gableman was also making. So that seems to me to be the quintessential part in this totality of circumstances when we look at the issue of, was there a seizure? Would a reasonable person feel free to leave? A reasonable person probably would not. A reasonable person has the directive, whether it's loud or soft, you know, I don't know. But there was a directive clearly to roll down the window. So
my point is that that is a sufficient show of force by the officer, or that would justify this being considered a seizure, because if we go through the facts, just like I've said before, the officer is free to be where he's at. He was free to park his car behind him. He was free to walk around the vehicle. He's free to, he could have, I think, sat there and said, is everything all right? And all that is okay. It is just when you rap on a window and you direct a person to roll down that window, that is, I don't believe Mr. Vogt would have felt that he was free, but it's not Mr. Vogt. It's a reasonable person in his position, and no reasonable person is going to feel free in this particular circumstance. Now, this is very limited factors because of the fact that if I will agree, too, if this, let's change him to being stopped on a street with nothing in front of him. Mr. Pozorski's argument is right. He had an exit. He could have ignored and drove forward. Is it likely he would have done that? Probably not. But at least he had an avenue to take under that circumstance. But this comes down to the fact, I also, whether, is this a consensual, such as when we look at the difference between Mendenhall and Royer, Florida versus Royer, they're almost a lot of the cases quite a bit the same. The difference is that in Mendenhall, they did not give her back her ticket or license, or Mendenhall, they gave her back after they had originally stopped her, asked the person for her license, her ticket, and took her luggage. They gave her back and then asked her to go to the room. So it became consensual under that.
Well, but
Florida
versus
Royer.
They also told her at the upfront of that encounter that she was free to say no.
Yes. And in Florida versus Royer, it was almost the same fact situation, but the DEA officers did not give back his ticket, did not give back his license, and they took him to another room without his getting his consent, and that was a show enough of to consider him to be seized. And so this case, I believe, is very, very much limited to its facts. And I believe that the facts that make it a seizure are because of the show of the force by the officer, however he directed him to roll down the window. He did, and however he rapped on the window, that's a sufficient showing of force. And then we have to decide, was he, Mr. Vogt, free to ignore and drive away? But with the being blocked on all four sides, how could he drive away and ignore this officer?
So that's your full circumstance. Not just the rap on the window, daintily and gently and kindly, or a request to do so. That's not necessarily a seizure yet in this case. But it becomes a seizure in this case because he can't exit. He cannot, as a physical matter, remove that car.
I would say that he is seized when the officer shows the police authority, or whatever you want to say, raps, knocks on the window. That he directs him to roll down the window,
right.
And then the associated facts are the facts he can't.
I thought you would say that, but then you get into the trouble of if it were a pedestrian and he just asked him to stop and answer a question, the courts have said that's not a seizure.
Correct.
And yet when you put him in a car, according to your theory, it becomes a seizure.
The court is, there's... are a lot of cases out there that says that the courts will recognize your right to be left alone in a vehicle. It's just a lesser expectation of privacy. But that privacy interest still exists. It's just lesser than being in a house.
And in this case, you don't have to go that far if you're right that there was no way of exiting and you got a criminal statute that might have been a flea here.
As the judge pointed that out, I would also say that I've never heard of a temporary seizure. You're either seized or you're not. Judge VandeHei finding a temporary seizure is, I believe, incorrect in that he found that to be, I don't know, law. I guess that would be law, not fact, but he did find a temporary seizure. And under the law, I believe there's no such thing as a temporary seizure.
His ultimate conclusion here was there was no seizure in violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Yes, so that was his ultimate conclusion.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, counsel, unless there are further questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Pozorski.
Thank you, Your Honor, Chief Justice. I have a few responses to make to counsel's arguments, but certainly answer any questions that the court has. It seems to me that the way counsel argues it is, well, the Chief Justice summarized it pretty well, but almost for what Attorney Scott is saying is that you almost can't have, you can't talk to the person if the person is in the car. He says it's okay, the officer would have been fine if the officer would have just walked up and stood on the side. It's okay if the officer would have walked up and instead of just standing on the side of the car, would have walked around the car. You know, but the law, when we look at these other cases, you know, says that an officer can approach, can ask for identification, and can pose some questions. But the way counsel describes it is if that person happens to be sitting in a car, then
I don't think that's what he's saying. I did not hear him say that the defining element was the fact of the suspect sitting in a car. I heard him say the show of force being used by the officer in directing the suspect to roll the window. Who knows? Does it come down to, say, instead of the early morning hours of December 25 in Wisconsin, it was a beautiful June evening, and all the windows were down.
Right.
And then the officer comes up to the automobile. He wouldn't be able to make, your opposing counsel would not be able to make the same argument he's making today, because in response to several questions from the Chief Justice, basically, no offense, pinning him down on what he thought the defining factor was, he said it was the direction to roll the window down.
Right.
So the whole idea of the fact of the suspect being in the car is not the defining, it's the display of force.
Right, to roll down the window.
Right.
Right. I agree. And but then would that mean that it's okay for the officer to approach as long as the windows are open, but if the windows are not open, then the officer cannot complete what Mendenhall would allow, which is to ask some questions and to ask for identification? Because with the window up, if you don't have the person roll the window down, which is a barrier to communication, then you're left saying that, well, but Mendenhall really doesn't apply here.
Your opposing counsel's rejoinder to that would probably be, one requires the display of authority, roll the window down.
Right.
And the other does not.
Yep. That's probably true, too. But this court has stated in Young that not every show of authority constitutes a seizure.
or transforms a consensual encounter into a seizure, which then when you read that logically, it means that sometimes there can be a show of authority and it still wouldn't rise to a seizure. So based upon Young, which says that you can have a show of authority and it still doesn't transform it to a seizure, then even if you look at it, say, directing him to put down the window, was a show of authority. You know, the sum and substance of my argument and his argument is that show of authority is too much. My argument is that show of authority is not enough to label it as being so intimidating and so oppressive as to cause a reasonable person to feel as if he or she cannot disregard the officer's attempts to communicate with him or her.
Counsel, I have the impression that if the officer had done everything the officer did, but in addition merely uttered the words, "Is everything all right here?" we wouldn't be here.
You're assuming, or is your suggestion that if he had uttered that before he directed him to roll the window down?
No. Roll the window down. Is everything all right here? I think we might not be here. What's your response to my musing?
I don't think that would answer the question because once he directs them to roll the window down and says, and even if he said, "Is everything all right here?" the person says, "Yeah, everything's fine. I'm just talking to Kimberly here." But at that point, you know, the officer smells the odor of an alcoholic beverage and then we know how these things play out. You know, once you smell the odor, click, 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 everything works its way through. But defense attorneys say that, you know, they almost have the reports prepared ahead of time. And we say, no, that's not true. No, but we know how these things play out. You smell the odor, and there you go.
Yeah, but the point is, he would have been, if he was in a caretaker function, is everything okay?
Yes,
he would
have
been in a proper place, and then you would have had plain smell test.
Right, that's true. Yeah, then it would be a caretaker function.
Caretaker function, the end.
Right, I agree.
But as soon as you don't have the words, "Are you all right?" or words to the equivalent, "Can I help you?"
Right?
"I'm here to help you." Right? Then you don't have the caretaker function. You don't claim the caretaker function. Therefore, you do not have the officer in a proper position to smell. That's the problem.
Right. I would agree. I would agree that we wouldn't be here, and I apologize for missing your point. But I agree that if that would have happened, the defendant would still be found guilty, and we wouldn't be arguing before here today.
I can see that as the top area of instruction for law enforcement in the next class.
Right. That's true.
All right.
My light is red. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both counsel. As you all know, seizure is one of the frequent issues that come before the court, whether or not there's been a lawful compliance with the Fourth Amendment in the Wisconsin Constitution. I think we get several each year, and we're making our quota this year, too. I want to thank both of you for excellent briefs and arguments on the issue. And that closes our hearing on 2012 AP 1812, County of Grant versus Vogt. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear the third case today. I want to thank the Hamilton students for coming, and we wish you well on your trip back home and that you had a successful day in the Capitol. We are in recess.